From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield has laryngitis. Really, he does.
And I'm Bob Garfield. I think I'll just be quiet for a little while.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As you certainly know by now, Mississippi Republican Trent Lott has relinquished his role as Senate Majority Leader. He was dislodged by a wave of condemnation that followed a comment he made at Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday party. Thurmond ran for president on a segregationist platform in 1948.
I want to say this about my state. When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him. We're proud of it. And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years either.
According to New York Post columnist John Podhoretz, the credit, or the blame, for the fall of Trent Lott belongs to a group that lives solely in cyberspace, the bloggers. The term bloggers comes from blog, which comes from weblog. Bloggers are innumerable and opinionated, and they are all over the web, chatting, arguing, spinning the news, and making the news. In fact, Trent Lott's infamous birthday party comment burst into the headlines because of the blogs. John Podhoretz joins me now. Welcome to On the Media.
Thanks, Brooke.
So it's bloggers that made hay of the Trent Lott story. Do you know on which blog and by whom?
Well, the most important figure in this story is probably Josh Marshall, who runs a blog called TalkingPointsMemo.com. The Lott story broke on a Friday, and over the weekend, Marshall highlighted it. Other people saw it there. Another blogger named Atreus then ran with it as well, dug up some very interesting stuff and horrifying stuff about the Mississippi Democratic Party's record that belied Trent Lott's claim that support for Strom Thurmond was largely about defense issues in 1948. And I think most importantly for the viability of this story, conservative bloggers led by Andrew Sullivan, whose blog is at andrewsullivan.com, by David Frum, who has a blog on the National Review website, and others leapt on the story, demanded Lott's resignation, said that the Republican Party and the conservative movement were at a crucial crossroads, moral, spiritual, and political crossroads. And had they not gone as passionately and ardently with the story and with this moral demand, I'm not sure that it would have had the legs that it had.
Now, Frum and Sullivan are professional journalists. There are lots of amateur blogs. Did amateurs help feed the fire?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Atreus is an amateur. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of these sites. There is a wonderful sort of clearinghouse. The Reader's Digest of the blog world is run by a man named Glenn Reynolds, a professor at the University of Tennessee, who runs a website called instapundit.com. in which he surveys the things that are said on these and other blogs. And all through that first week, he was saying, take a look at this site, take a look at that site, take a look at the other site. What you have in this blog world are individuals who, in previous eras, and indeed probably even now, their only real outlet would have been writing letters to the editor or making a phone call to a journalist with a tip, with a piece of information. These people now function as a kind of rough first draft. If, you know, daily newspapers are the first draft of history, these are like rough first drafts of history. They're leaping into the debate with information and passion and enthusiasm in some ways that reporters, professionals, may have lost because they're so used to covering politicians, so used to understanding that politicians speak cant and blather, that their ears have been dulled. And I think that's actually part of the story here, is that the reporters who were at this party for Thurmond didn't quite hear what Lott said.
Do you think that a year or two ago, bloggers would have had enough influence to put the Senate Majority Leader's job in jeopardy?
No. I think what we're seeing here is the ripening of an entirely new journalistic form. As is always the case when new media start, it's the people who are willing to sacrifice their time and effort out of passion that make something viable. And what you have here is people who are doing this not because what they want is to corner a market, but because they want to become part of the national debate.
John, are there any other stories from this year, big or small, that were flushed out first on the weblogs?
Interestingly enough, a lot of stories get counterspun by the weblogs. The New York Times, for example, a lot of the New York Times' coverage over the summer of the looming war with Iraq was called into very powerful question by bloggers who compelled the Times, I think, in some ways to correct a very misleading story that was done about Henry Kissinger and his opinion about the war. And so there's a lot of that stuff going on in which mainstream journalistic publications are feeling pressure from the kinds of information and knowledge that are being disseminated on these weblogs, which are, after all, reachable the same way you can reach a story in the New York Times sometimes just by going to a search engine like Google or something and typing a phrase in. You might get a New York Times story, or you might get a story from a blogger.
Now, one of the bloggers who's spent a lot of time dogging the New York Times is Mickey Kouse. His Kouse Files you can reach from Slate.com. Now, he posits the notion that the bloggers were fed the Trent Lott case via email by Sid Blumenthal, a member of the Clinton administration. Kouse says that Blumenthal started the ball rolling in the blogs that ultimately rolled over Trent Lott.
First of all, I don't doubt that that's true. And if Sid Blumenthal, of whom I'm not a fan, you know, had been handing out false or silly or pointless information, whatever it was, it wouldn't have made an impact. The fact is that people have been feeding journalists forever. It is perfectly legitimate for Sid Blumenthal or anybody to try to get word out about something that he's upset about. That's what letting 1,000 flowers bloom on the web means. It means you don't have to depend on the New York Times or on the Washington Post or on ABC or on CNN or on Fox News or on NPR to get information out and part of the debate.
Well, John, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
John Podhoretz writes for the New York Post. His story about Trent Lott and the bloggers is called The Internet's First Scalp. Media consolidation was a big theme in 2002, and it looks like it's also an accurate prediction for 2003, at least in the TV industry. Popular cable channels are up for grabs in the new year as media giants get ready to swap networks. Viacom is eyeing USA, Comedy Central, and the Sci-Fi Channel, and ABC may soon be the sole owner of A&E, to name just a few prospective deals. Niche programming has made these small cable channels into household names, and according to OTM regular Max Robbins of TV Guide, new ownership can mean big changes in content.
Once upon a time, there was something called the Nashville Network, TNN. Well, when it became part of the Viacom family, all of a sudden it became something called the National Network, and you were trading the Grand Ole Opry for the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. I mean, that's a bit of a change, I'd say, Brooke.
That's definitely a big one. We were talking last week about BET. It was sold to Viacom. People were afraid that Black Entertainment Television would lose sight of part of its mission, which was to inform people about issues of particular interest to Black Americans. And, of course, we heard recently that they're canceling a couple of their important news programs. Viacom seems to be the company that is up to pick up a lot of these little cable stations. Do you think that means that there's going to be wholesale changes in format, like what happened to the Nashville Network, or something more subtle?
Given the networks in play, it'll probably be more subtle than that. Another network in play is Court TV. And again, there it would probably be just some tinkering with what they're doing now and actually what they're doing successfully.
Well, here's what I'm still not clear about. What is the impact, then, of this further consolidation in cable? These three big companies buying up whatever little independent channels are left. Is that going to make the programming better or worse?
It's really a hodgepodge, Brooke. I mean, you use the example of Viacom and BET, and it hasn't made BET better. And a lot of people expected it would with this infusion of cash, BT could become much more vital than it had been throughout its history. It didn't happen. However, you do see these situations where major corporations are in control and they let, as AOL Time Warner has done historically with HBO, let them really, given them a lot of rope. MTV, which is part of that Viacom family too, is doing a lot of innovative programming. All of it might not be my taste, but hey, I thought the Osbournes was a lot of fun in 2002.
One of the big deals of 2002 that wasn't was the proposed merger of ABC News and CNN. Is it going to happen in 2003?
People inside both organizations give it better than the 50-50 shot. A lot of people see this as a way for the Walt Disney Company, ABC's parent, to get out of the news business. They would rather be in entertainment. They see more profit in it. You know, when you talk to people who have gone from ABC News to CNN, I had a conversation with Jeff Greenfield, who did just that, and he said, the first thing you're struck by at CNN is how lean an organization it is. And they don't put, by and large, the same kind of money into production and presenting the news, the kind of the television part of TV news. However, they do have a much greater commitment to covering the world. And perhaps there is an upside to that. But I've talked to a lot of people inside ABC News who feel that this is really going to be perhaps even like the demise of a show like Nightline, that it no longer will have a place on ABC. They can push it off onto CNN, where it has less distribution, gets less promotion, and thus is less important.
It may be good for CNN?
It may be, in that they get the cream of the crop of ABC News to bolster that network. It may make them more competitive and give them a chance to once again regain their dominant position in the 24-hour news business, something that Fox now holds. But I'm not sure that ultimately this consolidation is a good thing for viewers. Less diversity and less competition. That doesn't mean better news.
Okay, Max, thanks very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Max Robbins writes the Robbins Report for TV Guide. Coming up next, who says what about whom on the web sparks lawsuits? Also new, internet courtrooms. This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. Paul Jordan of Flint, Michigan, thanked us for our interview with military analyst Bill Arkin, who outlined the Pentagon's plans for an information war. Jordan wrote, "Call me a cynic, but it seems to me that a great way to give a patina of truth to a strategically false story would be to plant it overseas, where it would inevitably filter back to shape our view of events and the world. It seems to me that it would be easy to do, and if the will to do it is present, it will be done." And listener Dale Heltzer weighed in on our piece about the disappearing rock instrumental. "I wonder what OTM gap Frankenstein by Edgar Winter disappeared into. Surely this is an outstanding showpiece for what could be done with the synthesizer. Also, I love the way the dramatic tension built up to an almost unbearable level by not playing Green Onions until the very end of the piece. Green Onions is the absolutely most totally way cool instrumental in the entire 4.5 billion year history of Earth." We interviewed Fortune magazine columnist Adam Leshinsky on a new rule proposed by the New York Stock Exchange that would compel newspapers to disclose the financial interests of the analysts they quote. Leshinsky said the rule acts as a gag order, limiting freedom of the press. But Jeffrey Silverstein of New York City found that position embarrassingly hypocritical. Holier than all the rest of us, newspaper and magazine authors are what? Honorable enough, smarter than everyone else, and therefore should be allowed to police themselves after 5 years of admitted collusion with dishonest appraisals of investment opportunities? Please be honest and change your name to By and For the Media. We were accused of lobbing more softballs by Tom Howe, a self-described libertarian in North Carolina. In our interview with FCC Commissioner Michael Copps, Howe writes, "You lobbed. Explain why media consolidation is bad. Why not just ask him to make a speech?" I would have liked to hear him answer, "Why should citizens believe that the greatest of all monopolies, the government, would make a better filter for news than any possible combination of businesses?" But no, you invited the advocate of the biggest, the only coercive monopoly there is, and handled him with kid gloves. Maybe you should call your show Stomp on the Media. We hear it. Whatever you want to call us, do want to hear from you, so send your letters to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and please don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. There's a New Yorker cartoon of a dog sitting in front of a computer tapping a keyboard, and the caption reads, "On the internet, no one knows you're a dog." It turns out no one knows if you're Dow Chemical either. Activists have learned the fine art of perfectly mimicking corporate websites and filling them with ironic, caustic, would-be promotional copy. For example, the very official-looking fake Dow Chemical website crassly excuses that company's involvement in the gas leak that killed over 20,000 people in Bhopal, India, in December of 84. The fake website has enraged the real Dow Chemical and the PR firm that represents it, Burson Marsteller, which also, by the way, has its very own fake website, courtesy of our guest, Hampshire College sophomore Paul Hardwin. Burson Marsteller is now suing Hardwin, and it's easy to see why. The fake websites are filled with incriminating copy, but they look identical to the real ones.
Well, it's interesting because as an imposter, you have a lot more credibility on the internet. So if I was walking around claiming to be Burson Marsteller in person, it wouldn't go over too well. I'd get arrested pretty quickly. But on the net, companies are still just sort of figuring out how to flex their muscle. They're being outsmarted a lot faster than they can respond. The purpose of this project is to highlight what happened in Bhopal on the anniversary and to highlight the involvement of the public relations industry and specifically of Burson Marsteller, which did business with all sorts of foreign dictatorships, various corporations with, you know, unethical business practices, et cetera, et cetera. So, But it began as a project just sort of for fun. I mean, a domain name costs $10 to register or something like that.
Well, what does your fake website say about Burson Marsteller that you think enraged them the most?
The Dow Chemical site is one of many sites created with a software called Dreamweaver. The way it works is you give the software a website address and you tell it words that you want to switch around. So I have some examples here of words that were switched around. Whenever the software found the term workforce, it replaced it with the term profit army. The word community was replaced with the word marketplace. The word peace was replaced with the words cheap oil. Basically, it's an automated process. So, you know, whereas activism takes a lot of time, you know, you have to make your banner, your puppets, your posters, whatever. You have to get in a bus, drive to a big city. It's noisy. There's a lot of police around. They beat you up, etc. This thing, you know, you do it from the comfort of your own home, and it looks like the site is current, and, you know, it pulls the site automatically and switches out the words, and so you have a fairly automatic parody machine.
Well, what struck me is how similar your fake websites are to the original corporate websites. I was looking at the Dow website. The real one has a little script at the top that said, "Did you know?" And then it says, Dow manufacturing experts produce life-saving pharmaceutical products such as Renagel, a promising new drug for kidney failure patients. Now, on your website, under Did You Know, you write, Dow is responsible for the birth of the modern environmental movement. In 1962, Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring about the side effects of a Dow product, DDT, another example of Dow's commitment to living improved daily. I mean, that one isn't very subtle, but do you ever wonder that occasionally you are being too subtle for your target audience?
Well, it's a very specific kind of activism, I think. It's a new market. It's an emerging market. I think the experience of viewing the website is supposed to be a little bit unsettling. It's not supposed to jump out at you. So you're supposed to read it, and you're supposed to, you know, think about it a little bit and say, well, why are they being so honest?
And the people that you're reaching are actually people who presumably are looking for the Burstyn Marsteller website or the Dow Chemical website. So you are certainly not preaching to the converted, which I guess is why you've elicited some responses like these. Somebody writing, you are evil incarnate. Have you no sense of decency? And is this supposed to make me feel better, or is this some mentally deranged person's idea of a joke? Are you glad you're getting responses like that?
There's a lot of lunatics out there. I have to think that I'm more credible than Burstyn Marsteller, honestly, so I trust what I'm putting out there.
Well, tell me, how is the lawsuit going? Are there enough free speech loopholes to let you slip past? Do they have a case?
I think they have a really poor case, but I think they are Burstyn Marsteller. But it's very difficult to make a case in front of the World Intellectual Property Organization that is successful and that successfully counteracts one of these complaints. They almost always rule in favor of the complainant. So it's really about remembering this incident in Bhopal, and it's really about getting some publicity out about this sort of activism and the way that corporations are able to shut it down really with a snap of their fingers.
So what other 900-pound gorillas are you planning to incite?
I'm working on several of these sites. I have been for a while. But there's really hundreds of these websites out there. So my advice is if you're going to be contacting a major corporation, you should use the telephone.
Paul Hardwin, good luck and thank you very much.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
Paul Hardwin is a sophomore at Hampshire College, and he has a big career ahead of him as a troublemaker. Australia's highest court has made a decision that gives prominent businessman Joseph Gutnick permission to sue Dow Jones & Company for defamation over a 7,000-word article that was published in Barron's in October of 2000. What makes this a landmark case, and the reason why media lawyers in this country are shaking their heads in disbelief, is that Gutnick is going to be allowed to sue in his home state of Victoria, Australia, even though Barron's operation is based in New York City. Now, we like our First Amendment, and for the most part, we like the idea of the Internet as a global engine for free expression. The Australia ruling sets a dramatic precedent that lawyers and publishers will be watching very closely. Every time a media lawyer makes a decision to hold a story or wave it through, they may have to consider not just the laws in this country, but also the laws in any country with an interest in the story. Sandy Barron heads the Libel Defense Resource Center, and she joins me now. Sandy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sandy, briefly, what does the Australia decision mean for publishers on the Internet?
At its most narrow, what the Australian decision means is that any publisher who is writing about an individual or corporation that can claim to have a reputation in Australia has theoretically opened itself up to litigation in Australia.
Well, libel has been pretty much decriminalized in this country, hasn't it? What are the important differences between the U.S. approach to libel and defamation and the Australian approach, which I understand is based on English common law?
It is based on English common law, and in fact, so was our law until 1964, when the Supreme Court of the United States, in a truly landmark ruling, decided that the First Amendment to our Constitution, which allows for free press and free speech, applied to libel and imposed some very strong restrictions on the ability of plaintiffs to win libel suits. And among those restrictions is a requirement that the plaintiff prove, for example, that what he claims is defamatory is also false. That's not required under English common law or in Australia. A plaintiff in this country has to prove that the defendant published whatever he claims is defamatory with fault, either negligently or knowingly falsely, None of that, again, would be true in Australia. Indeed, all an Australian plaintiff basically has to do is be alive and appear in court and claim that something defamatory was published by the defendant. At that point, virtually all of the balls shift to the defendant to get himself out of the box.
So do you think Gutnick has a case?
Oh, I don't necessarily believe that at all. I think Dow Jones probably did a very good job in its reporting. I have no reason to believe otherwise. And fortunately, Dow Jones at least has the resources to do what it needs to do in order to fight the claim in Australia. I think the people who need to be more concerned are those without that kind of resource. What you find in English courts that you do not find to the same degree in American courts is that English press settle their cases a lot more frequently than American media do. And they do so not necessarily because they think what they printed was false, or they think it was wrong, or that they think it's not in the public interest. They may think all of that is true. It is because the costs of litigating are so high. And if they lose, they not only have to pay their own costs, but they have to pay the plaintiff's attorney's fees and costs. It can be staggering. It can be crippling.
If something that you write in your newspaper that goes up on the internet winds up in Zimbabwe and you face a ruinous lawsuit and people in Zimbabwe are able to bring you to court, that might cause you to pull your punches, at least with regard to what you put on the web.
I think that's a very legitimate fear. And it may be that we will see that what is published on the web is decidedly less interesting, less vigorous, less, period, than what we now see published in print in the United States. But it's hard to imagine that new world. It is possible that technology will provide a solution, a mechanism by which publications can limit the reach of readership on the internet. I think that's unlikely, however. I think a more likely scenario, and a good one, would be the adoption of an international treaty that would give some certainty to which law and whose law will govern cases like this. Preferably, I would think, from the perspective of the media, the law of the country in which the media publishes.
Well, Sandy Baron, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Sandy Baron heads the Libel Defense Resource Center, based here in New York City. The internet may be sparking a wide variety of conflicts, but it also has the power to resolve them. Right now, there are about 40 websites devoted to brokering disputes, and now the technology is catching the attention of law schools. This month, law students from about 40 schools and 15 countries began what in legalese is called an Online International Alternative Dispute Resolution Moot Court. Susan Kaplan offers this translation.
Imagine for a minute that you own a corporation in Singapore that sells, let's say, widgets to a company in the United States. And the widgets are made in Indonesia. But there's a problem. Some recently shipped widgets are defective. Peter Monzo was a third-year law student at Texas Wesleyan Law School when he and his teammate dealt with this exercise in last year's competition.
We were representing the client from Singapore who sold the product to the corporation in the United States. Of course, we did not want to litigate. We did not want to pay damages, but we wanted to continue to do business with this company.
Monzo's goal was to negotiate a settlement. He says mediation and arbitration are less adversarial than the courts when it comes to dealing with parties from different jurisdictions, and in this case, different countries. His goal was to fashion an agreement designed to keep both sides happy. But unlike most legal wrangling, this process took place completely online. So Monzo says his team began by creating a set of rules.
Simple things like, please do not write more than one question at a time. Allow us time to respond to your first question before you send another. Also, if you do not respond within 5 minutes, please tell us that you are thinking over what we have written or that you need to leave or whatever. Just trying to develop an e-etiquette.
Monzo says this e-etiquette was crucial because common but tricky problems can derail a transaction in the virtual legal environment. There's that moment, he says, when you push the send button and wonder if that's really what you wanted to say. In the end, Monzo's team won the gold medal. Texas Wesleyan Law professor Ben Davis, who helped organize the event, says he was surprised by how many schools from all over the world expressed interest in fielding a team.
If you can imagine sort of a set of rooms on a wall, sort of like in tic-tac-toe, if you click on one box and in there you would see students from Australia and negotiating with students from France, and in the next room you click over another box and you'd have students from Canada negotiating with students from New Zealand.
Davis, who spent a decade working for the International Chamber of Commerce in Paris, says trying to solve legal problems suits the internet because transactions naturally cross geographic boundaries. Ethan Katch, the director of the Center for Information Technology and Dispute Resolution at the University of Massachusetts, says mediation and arbitration are practical online alternatives to the court system.
If people are separated by great distances, state-based legal systems don't really work very well. They're just not appropriate because it's in general, faster, cheaper, and you don't have to worry about states and police forces and coercing people to appear in particular places, because we knew that couldn't happen. But the other intriguing thing is We did think that you could build what we call civic institutions online.
But, as the cliche goes, you can build it, but will they come? Katch, who's considered a pioneer in online dispute resolution, says it will take time and money to create what he calls a kind of internet conflict resolution infrastructure. He says SquareTrade, an online mediation company that works with eBay, has already handled some 300,000 disputes and is a good example of where the use of the technology is heading. Meanwhile, this year's competition is attracting about four times as many schools as last year, including a law school from Amman, Jordan, and Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Professor Ben Davis from Texas Wesleyan says the online moot court gives law students a chance to be projected into being international lawyers.
They were out competing with students from around the world. They didn't have to go through local, regional, or national competitions to get there. They didn't have to go anywhere. And they had this opportunity to try out their chops, to see how they did at it.
And Peter Monzo, who was on last year's winning team and who just passed the bar in Texas, says he's still enjoying the victory.
It was mind-boggling to me to win and then have someone say, well, you're the international champion. And I'm like, well, I never left the computer lab at Texas Wesleyan University School of Law's building.
Online mediation experts agree where humans meet to barter, exchange information, or to communicate in any way, there are bound to be conflicts, and they believe the internet can offer new options for resolving them. For On the Media, I'm Susan Kaplan.
Coming up, TV in classrooms, threat or menace, and a holiday gift from media junkies. This is On the Media from NPR. Back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And now for the latest communications phenomenon, smart mobs. Recently in the New York Times Magazine, writer Clive Thompson described Prince William's predicament. A student at the University of St. Andrews, he'll try to go for a quiet drink somewhere, but immediately he's mobbed by 100 young women who inform each other of his every move through text messages on their cell phones. One random sighting sent to 10 friends who each relay it to another 10, the result is a smart mob.
And what you get is something that works almost like the way bees talk to each other in a hive. No single bee is controlling the way the swarm works, yet it seems to move as though it has a mind of its own.
Sometimes these collections of people can become rather sinister.
Quite right. Down in Nigeria, when they had the Miss World pageants, those riots were at least partly inspired by smart mobs. What happened was when the newspaper article came out that was praising the Miss World pageant, and saying that Muhammad would have chosen one of the women for a partner, someone saw the article, got really incensed, and immediately sent out text messages to all of his friends, and they all did the same, so that within minutes, there were thousands of people in the city who knew about the article and were storming over to the offices of the publication. So there you had a smart mob that was not democratic and not good, which makes sense, of course, because, you know, we've had mobs around for a long time, and sometimes they're democratic, and sometimes they're good, and sometimes they're about lynching.
They can also be an instrument of political movements, can't they? I mean, they were used a few years ago back in Seattle.
Sure. The whole reason that the protests in Seattle over the World Trade Organization happened was because they didn't operate like a normal protest. A normal protest is centralized, and it's very easy for the police to disperse them if they want because they're all in one place. What was happening in Seattle is that they were using mobile devices ranging from walkie-talkies to cell phones to other things to work in groups of maybe 50. And so you had, you know, thousands of people composed of small cells of 50 people who, if they needed to, could all break up, you know, disappear through the streets and reform somewhere else.
You were telling me before we started the interview that Japan, the place that we normally look for high-tech advances, is a place where we'll probably see this thing evolve to the next level.
Absolutely. Over in Japan, you've got phones that can already take really robust pictures. They're beginning to be able to send video. They can do incredibly complex forms of networking. And there's a lot of indications that this is going to change even the way that we think of gathering information and sharing it with each other.
Well, give me an example. Right now, you can send still pictures from one person to another over a cell phone. Pretty soon, you'll be able to send even moving pictures over a cell phone. Is this how people are going to one day get their news?
Absolutely. I think that I've heard this prediction, and I think it's true, that in the next year, there is going to be a major disaster or news event in Hong Kong or Tokyo, and the first images you're going to see of it are going to be taken by 100 people who are right next to it with cell phones, taking video, taking pictures, or sending text about it. And CNN is going to use that video and use those pictures because they're going to be there before the news cameras arrive. In a sense, what smart mobs do is turn everybody into a guerrilla on the fly reporter.
Now, Howard Rheingold, who coined the term smart mob, argues that the convergence of all of these wireless communications technologies will one day create shifts along the lines of those that began to occur when people first settled into villages and formed nation states, that this is going to reconfigure the way that people gather, the way that people move, the way that they communicate. Do you think he's exaggerating just a tad?
You know, in the long run, I don't think so. Because he is talking about something that's an extension of what's happening on the internet already, which is that we now have very real and powerful communities that aren't bounded by geography. And the thing that smart mobs with cell phones and mobile devices does is that it adds an extra dimension of weirdness to it because, you know, you're standing in the street now, but you're connected to other people all over the world or in different places or maybe a block over. So you have these extra layers of community. I can't even say exactly what that's going to do, but I know it's going to be significant and disruptive.
Well, Clive, thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Clive Thompson wrote about smart mobs for the New York Times Magazine's second annual Year in Ideas. Channel One, the daily TV news program piped into 40% of U.S. secondary schools, is now 12 years old, just a little bit younger than its intended audience. And it's always been on the defensive. But the pressure has mounted lately, brought to bear by critics who say the classroom is an inappropriate venue for the network's commercials. The schools do receive free video equipment from Channel One as part of the deal, but opponents say that's not good enough. Recent showdowns have resulted in wins for both sides of the issue, as OTM's Paul Ingalls reports.
An oil tanker has broken apart in the Atlantic Ocean, about 150 miles off the coast of northwest Spain.
The school day has just begun in teacher Steve Chavez's first period history class at Albuquerque's McKinley Middle School. All eyes are trained on the TV suspended from the ceiling at the front of the room.
For 7 days, the oil tanker Prestige wallowed in heavy seas, leaking oil after its hull cracked during a storm.
Like an estimated 8 million teens in classrooms across the country, these eighth graders are watching Channel One News on televisions the network donated to the school in exchange for the students' attention. Youthful news anchors Janet Choi and Derek Shore are today's hosts of a 12-minute show that looks much like any network newscast, only all the reporting is done by young folks who seem to know their stuff.
Errol Barnett is in Washington, D.C. with that story. Hi, Errol.
What's going on, Derek? You know, this lame duck Senate stayed late to vote on and pass the Homeland Security bill.
The students watch closely and scribble down notes because they know they'll get a quiz on the news from Mr. Chavez. Just like on the network news, this show has commercials. 2 minutes that specifically target teens, advertising video games, TV shows, movies, beauty products, and music. Or it's public service announcements, many with anti-drug messages.
On the WB Friday.
When the ads come on today, Mr. Chavez has a student assigned to hop up and turn the sound down, and he starts quizzing the class.
Hey, what did they call the sides of the boat? What's the side of a boat called? It's called the hull, H-U-L-L.
Chavez says he doesn't always turn the commercials down, but he is selective as he tries to teach the persuasive power of advertising.
If it's a commercial that's like a public service announcement for kids, like talking about depression, talk to somebody, or, you know, school violence, tell a counselor, then I'll let it run. But if it's a commercial trying to sell them video games, oftentimes we'll mock and laugh at the fact that one video game has all the commercials for 3 days in a row.
While Channel One News and its ads are used as learning tools in this class, according to McKinley principal Scott Elder, it may have less impact for students in, say, a first period math class, where it also must be shown.
And I see teachers that use it in a real instructional and powerful manner. I see other teachers who aren't as involved with it, and I don't know if their kids get as much from it.
Critics say classrooms offer a captive teen audience for the ads, and lately groups that normally don't hang out together much, like conservative Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum and Ralph Nader's Oregon-based Commercial Alert Organization, have become more active in their opposition to the network. They're teaming up with some teacher and health organizations and concerned parents to get legislators and local school boards to reconsider Channel One.
The kids are a captive audience, and they definitely do watch the commercials. And I believe if you were an advertiser, you're definitely getting bang for your buck.
McKinley principal Scott Elder.
But these kids are inundated with commercials and advertising and are attacked by the media at so many levels that I'm not sure that 2 minutes has that big of an impact.
That's one argument heard often from teachers and administrators who like Channel One and, according to the network, keep renewing contracts and recommending the service. But Channel One opponents insist those 2 minutes do have more impact. Showing them in class implies a school endorsement, they say.
The kids have to report to school because of compulsory attendance laws, and to make commercials a part of that school day is reprehensible to me.
Jim Metrock is an Alabama businessman who also runs a nonprofit organization that's been campaigning to get Channel One out of schools since 1996.
That time should be taken with more reading and other things that are academic and not promoting junk food, violent, sexy movies, and other things that have no place in a school day, whether it's a regular length or extended length.
Metrock collects the ads he thinks are least appropriate for teens, posts them on his website, and makes videotapes available to local groups taking on Channel One. The tapes made it to some members of the Texas State Board of Education this fall and convinced member Judy Strickland to bring a resolution to the board.
And be it further resolved that the State Board of Education encourages each Texas school district to discontinue the showing of Channel 1 to shield students from its commercial influences.
The proposed resolution singling out Channel 1 would still leave the decision on the service to local districts. But with education trends in Texas watched closely by the nation, especially with George Bush in the White House, and with this huge state representing roughly 10% of Channel 1's total audience, the company sent in its top executives to mount a defense. Calling or meeting with board members to argue its case were former Christian Coalition head Ralph Reed, a Channel 1 supporter, and Jim Ritz, CEO of parent company Prime Media, and its vice president, Jeff Balaban.
How is it possible that 50,000 Texas educators watch Channel 1 every day for 12 years and think the content is wonderful, but a group in Oregon flies into Texas and creates a story about exploitative and hostile and negative and glorifying all kinds of bad behaviors? Clearly, there's a disconnect between reality and this group from Oregon.
I'd like to run just those first two pieces, please.
Prime Media CEO Jim Ritz appeared at the board's November meeting to roll his own video to counter the ad reel the opponents had shown. Two Channel 1 news pieces, one spotlighting First Lady and Texan Laura Bush, and the other an interview with a teen abstaining from sex, were more representative, Ritz said, of the typical quality of the show's content.
I'm very proud of the fact that this news program has won over 200 different educational and journalistic awards, including the George Foster Peabody Award and the Edward R. Murrow Responsibility in Television Award. I'm more, though, happy about the fact that we have such strong school approval.
The company tried to tap into this support by issuing what it labeled an urgent memo to its Texas school clients. Fringe political groups from outside Texas are working to take away Channel 1, it read in part. A stack of support letters poured into the board, some from students and parents, and many from teachers and principals, some who came to testify at the board meeting. Bonifacio Duran, an Austin school principal among them, reading from a teacher's letter.
I have seen many ideas come and go. Some of these resources have been well received and lauded by educators and administrators, but alas, fall short when presented to the students. Channel 1 hits the mark. Channel 1 is presented in their language, with their music and their interests at heart.
The board heard testimony from 10 speakers, a 5-5 split on the issue, with parent Linda Striegel from Heath, Texas, opposing Channel 1.
Why? Ask yourselves, why is Channel 1? Why did Prime Media want Channel 1 in the classroom? You know, Prime Media is publicly held. It's a targeted media company with two business segments, consumer and business to business. Well, where do our students fit in? They aren't a business, so I guess they view them as consumers. And that's not what our education is supposed to be used for, to teach our children to be consumers.
In the end, the Texas board passed a substitute resolution that removed any specific reference to Channel 1 and simply urged local districts to keep state education guidelines in mind when collaborating with commercial entities. It was a victory for Channel 1 that countered a few recent losses, like last year when the Seattle City Schools voted to phase out the service by 2005. Channel 1 opponents in Texas say they'll just move their campaigns next to the local school districts in this and other states. Meantime, Channel 1 officials say, in the still rare case that they're asked to leave a school, there's another one on its waiting list, ready to sign on. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
Remember the classic New York Daily News headline back in the 70s, Ford to City, Drop Dead? It had a potent political impact. And who can forget the legendary headless body and topless bar that graced the New York Post one day back in 1983? Tabloid papers like the Post and the News depend on big, splashy headlines to push newsstand sales, and there's a science to crafting them. Michael Shane and Mike Pearl, both veteran tabloid journalists, have created a card game called Man Bites Dog, which will bring the lurid world of sensational journalism to living rooms all over the country this Christmas. Back before Garfield lost his voice in a tragic holiday party accident, he managed this interview with Michael Shane.
Michael Shane joins me in the studio. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, let's give listeners a quick example of how this game is played. I'm going to deal myself five cards.
I'll take five here, too.
Now, you can exchange up to 3 cards if you don't like what you've been dealt.
That's correct.
Like poker, right?
Exactly. It's just like 5-card poker or 7-card stud. You can do it either way.
All right. So what do you have so far?
I have First Lady falls for blind girl. Not bad. I had to throw away one. I had to throw away suspect. I could do... Actually, it's not so bad. Suspect blind girl is sort of fun, isn't it? First Lady falls for suspect blind girl?
No, this is something like poker, but also something like Scrabble, because different words have different point values assigned to them.
Precisely.
For example, blonde is 25 points, but lady is only 5. Why is that?
In the newspaper business, especially in the tabloid business, certain concepts have more reach, more power than others. And blonde is a story about a blonde is going to be far more interesting any day than a story about a cleaning lady.
Okay. Now, there are some 50-point cards.
There's some heavy words in those. None is a 50-point word.
Bizarre is another one. Naked.
Naked
missing
always.
Missing is worth 50. Now, here's one I'm a little surprised at. 50 points, urologist.
Oh, please. Are you kidding me? The word urologist in a headline is going to make you stop and read that story. Guaranteed.
Okay, falls for is worth 25. Runs off with is worth 50. The lowest scoring cards among them are feds, czar, tourist, and Wall Street. Now, why don't they have the oomph that urologist has?
Tourist. I think that's probably a reflection of our New York bias. Once again, something happens to a tourist, who cares? Skip right over that story.
Forgive me, I don't want to put words in your mouth or in your hand, but what I'm beginning to understand is that the actual fundamental news value of the story is not what matters, but rather the drama with which this story can be headlined. Am I jumping to conclusions here?
I think that would be fair. How you project a story, especially in a tabloid newspaper with limited space, is really, really important. You're a newsstand sale paper. Papers like The Post and The Daily News don't have a lot of home delivery. You've got to sell papers to people on their way to work. You have to sell them when they're out at lunch. And in a sense, what really matters is the way a story is projected and not so much what goes on underneath the headline.
Is there something about journalism that we can learn by playing Man Bites Dog?
I think so, and that was really one of the reasons we did it, too. It's to show that there's myths to all these newspapers and all these newspaper stories, and it's true for all newspapers. At the New York Post, our myths are pretty easy. The little guy can be a hero, the rich are unhappy, miracles do happen. At the New York Times, they, too, have their own myths. They have myths like everybody means well. That's why they call everybody Mister, by the way. There's got to be 2 or 3 sides to every story, so you don't get that same kind of good guy, bad guy interplay that you get with a popular press. And this is meant to show you that the popular press traffics not in politics but in ideas, and the ideas are the things that make people common among themselves. It has to do with sex and with death.
All right. Well, Michael, media host, thanks, guest.
Thank you very much.
Michael Shane is the co-creator of Man Bites Dog, a family game in which you can write your own tabloid headlines.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, with Megan Ryan and Emily Ford, engineered by Rob Christensen and Dylan Keefe, and edited by me. We had help from Sharon Ball and Natasha Kurgankar. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.